If you take a lemon and add desire to it, that's where you get the lemonade. Charles Kettering, for example, had a lemon. I don't know if there's anybody who's listening to this recording who's old enough to know this, but years and years ago, they used to have cranks on automobiles. How many of you in the live audience ever used an old crank to start an automobile? Well, for the benefit of those who don't know what I'm talking about, it's at the front of the automobile, and you stand down there, and you turn that sucker, and that's the way you get that engine started. Well, Charles Kettering was out there cranking his car one day, and it kicked him. Now, there's some mechanical procedures that you go through to explain what happens when the car kicks you, but I had a mechanical bypass when I was a child, so I don't understand quite what all of that is. All I know is that the car will lurch forward, and that's what happened to Kettering, and it broke his arm. Well, obviously, he was in pain. He grabbed his arm, and no sooner had it happened than he got to thinking to himself, you know, as long as we have this problem, the automobile never will be very popular. And it was that broken arm that led him to discover the self-starter, to invent the self-starter. You see, his lemon was a broken arm. His lemonade was the self-starter. Jacob Schick had a lemon. He was prospecting for gold up in Alaska, and he wanted to shave. But at 40 degrees below zero, by the time you poured the water in the pan there, it was too cold to shave, so he invented the electric razor. Neil Jeffrey was a third-string freshman quarterback down at Baylor University, and he went to the coach one day, Coach Grant Taft, and said, I want to be the starting quarterback. The problem with Neil was he stuttered. Now, I don't know what you know about playing quarterback, but that's a position that really does require very fluid speech. I mean, so that you can say what you want to say. You know, there's a second clock up there that you only take so many seconds to get those plays off. And with a lot of stuttering going on, you're going to be called for delay of game about half the time. Well, Neil Jeffrey was an unusual young man. And as I say, he was third string quarterback on the freshman team. But he went to Coach Grant Taft at Baylor, and he said, I want to be the starting quarterback. In 1974, not only was he the starting quarterback, but he led Baylor to its first conference championship in over 50 years and was the most valuable player in the Southwest Conference that year, leading his team into the Cotton Bowl. A lot of times when things happen, we can capitalize on them. If you were to go down to Enterprise, Alabama, there is an unusual statue in the town square. It's a statue to the boll weevil. Now, the reason they erected the statue to the boll weevil is very simple. At one time in that part of the country, cotton was king. It was the only crop they raised. The economy rose and fell on king cotton. And many times people suffered as a direct result of it. There was no diversification. And this one particular year, the boll weevil just ran wild in that part of the country. I mean, that sucker ate every bite of cotton that was within 40 miles of Enterprise, Alabama. The farmers absolutely suffered a total, complete loss. And as a result of that, they recognized at long last what they had been told for many years, and that is that they needed to diversify. And so they started raising peanuts and soybeans and corn and many, many other crops. And the economy was so much better that they thought it would be appropriate if they erected the statue right there in the center of town to the boll weevil, because the boll weevil is the one who had forced the issue. Many times when things happen to us, if we will look at what has happened, we can determine that maybe that is the best thing that has ever happened to us after all. Charles Goodyear's lemon, for example, was a prison sentence. He was sent to prison because he wouldn't pay a certain bill. And while he was there, he had the time and privacy to work on his process for vulcanizing rubber. And that's exactly what he did, and perfected the process while he was in prison. Martin Luther, while he was confined to Wartburg Castle, gave us the German translation of the Bible. John Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress when he was in prison. Gene Tunney became the heavyweight boxing champion of the world because he broke both of his hands. Now, that might sound like a very unusual statement, but when Tunney was a young fighter, he was fighting with the American Expeditionary Forces during World War II over in France. He broke his right hand, and then later he broke his left hand. His trainer and the doctor said, "Gene, you simply are never going to be able to make it to become the heavyweight champion of the world because your hands simply are too brittle. They will not stand up under all of this heavy punching that's required to be the heavyweight champion of the world." But Gene Tunney had a tremendous desire to become the heavyweight champion. He said, "I will become the most scientific boxer to ever get in the ring. I will box my way into the heavyweight championship." Well, all of us know, of course, that he did win the heavyweight boxing championship from Jack Dempsey, that he did retire as the undefeated heavyweight champion of the world. But ring experts are virtually unanimous in agreement when they say that had he not broken his hands, he never would have been the heavyweight champion. Because undoubtedly he would have attempted to slug it out with Dempsey, would not have learned the boxing skills, and the smart money of that day said that no man alive could stand up to Jack Dempsey in a toe-to-toe slugging battle. He won the championship because he had the desire, because he broke his hands, and because he took that lemon, and out of it he made the lemonade. I'm trying to deliver the same message in 100 different ways, and that simply is that when adversity strikes, maybe that adversity is what you need in order to become successful. If we have enough desire, it certainly will make a difference. When John Kish of Houston, Texas, lost his sense of hearing, many people thought that because he was a stockbroker, a salesperson, if you will, that his career as a salesperson was over. But John Kish was not one to give up. So he did a lot of maneuvering. He is able to handle telephone calls now via three-way hookups with somebody else there interpreting kind of with the hands as he goes along. He handles personal interviews, and in the last 3 years, he's grossed over $1 million annually as a senior vice president in Oppenheimer's regional office down in Houston, Texas. I almost don't care what the situation is. If we add enough desire to it, then some things can happen that will make a difference. Now I'd like to share with you what I believe is the ultimate story as far as teaching is concerned. If you'll notice, I use an awful lot of examples, an awful lot of illustrations in order to cover certain points. The reason I do it is because people remember stories. They remember examples. And if you remember the story or remember the example, then it's easy to extract the lesson from that particular example. This particular story is one that I have been telling now for 23 years. And I tell this story because it involves virtually every principle in which I believe. It really covers the waterfront. In early 1965, I was in Kansas City where I was addressing my first really major seminar. When the seminar was over, I headed back to my room expecting to have a lonely dinner that evening. But as I stepped off the elevator, the booming voice of a man I've come to know and love as a brother sounded out, "Zig, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to dinner." He said, "Wait a minute." He said, "I'll go with you." It was Bernie Lofchick from Winnipeg, Canada. When we sat down, you have seen it happen where men just become instant friends. And I don't mean just buddies. I mean really close friends. We had about the same size families. His daddy died when he was very young. My daddy died when I was very young. He'd gone to work very early. I'd gone to work very early. He had gotten in the cookware business. I'd gotten in the cookware business. I mean, it was just an amazing thing. We sat down for dinner, and I said, "Bernie, you've certainly come a long way to a sales meeting." He said, "Yeah, you know, it really was magnificent. I got some wonderful ideas." Said, "It really was a great experience." Well, I kind of persisted, you know. I was going to find something negative to say there. So I said, "Yeah, but it sure cost you a lot of money to come from Winnipeg, Canada, down to Kansas City for a couple of days." Well, he said, "You know, Zig, thanks to my son, David, I don't really have to worry about money." I said, "Bernie, that sounds like a story. Would you share it with me?" He said, "Yes, I will." He said, "When our son David was born, our joy literally knew no bounds. We were elated. We already had our two girls. Now we had the boy. That's the family we wanted when we got married. But he said, it wasn't but a few days before we realized something was wrong. David's head hung too limply to the right side of his body. He drooled too much to be a normally healthy baby. But the doctor said, don't worry about it, he'll outgrow it. But you know, Zig, Bernie said, when it's your baby, you worry about it. We took him to a specialist, and the specialist, this was after about 6 months, the specialist, incredibly enough, diagnosed him with a condition he identified as the reverse of club's feet and treated him for that for several weeks. But Bernie said, you know, Zig, we knew it was more serious than that. So we went to another specialist. And this specialist, after a very exhaustive examination, told us, said, this little boy is a spastic. He has cerebral palsy. He's never going to be able to walk or talk or count to 10. I'm going to suggest that you put him in an institution for his own good and for the good of the, quote, normal members of the family. But Bernie looked at me and with those dark eyes of his flashed, and he said, Zig, but he said, you know, I'm not a buyer. I'm a seller. I could not conceive of my son living the life of a vegetable and growing up to be absolutely a nothing. I saw him in a different light altogether. So I asked the doctor if he knew of any other doctors, and all this specialist got highly indignant. He stood up. He said, I've given you the best advice you'll ever get. I suggest that you take it. And the interview was over. Bernie Loftick didn't take it. He went to another specialist who told him the same thing, and then another and another and another and yet another. 30 different specialists said, there is no hope for this little boy. Then they heard of a Dr. Perlstein from Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Perlstein was reputedly the number one authority in the world on cerebral palsy. But he was so busy that he was booked for 2 full years in advance. Bernie finally got his home phone, called him there, made an arrangement so that if there was a cancellation, that David would have the first alternate. Just 11 days later, a little boy from Australia canceled, and they bundled David up, flew him to Chicago for the examination. It was probably the most comprehensive physical that any child has been given up until that point. I mean, they really spent hour after hour after hour going over the baby. They threw out all of the other findings, all of the other x-rays. They just started from ground zero and went on with the examination. They called in the best expert in the world to read the x-rays, just to tell them what was there, to make no diagnosis, to make no recommendations, just tell me what you see in the x-ray. When it was all over, Dr. Perlstein and his nurses sat down with the Loftics, and they said, this little boy is a spastic. He has cerebral palsy. He's never going to be able to walk or talk or count to 10 if you listen to the prophets of doom. But he said, I happen to be solution conscious, not problem conscious. I believe there is something which you can do for this little boy if you are willing to do your part. The Loftics rather obviously said, well, doctor, you tell us, we will do anything that is humanly possible. Now, at that time, they could not easily afford a very heavy financial burden, but they said, spell it out, doctor, and we'll do what is necessary. And in minute detail, he said, you're going to have to work this little boy beyond all human endurance. Then you're going to have to work him some more. You will have to push him until he literally falls, and then you're going to have to pick him up. And you'll have to push him some more. You're going to have to be patience personified, because there will be many, many months where you will be unable to detect any progress at all. But if you ever stop, he will go all the way back, and then you will have to start all over. You're going to have to understand this is a lifetime commitment you're making, not something you do this year, next year, 5 years, or whatever. This is from now on. Well, the Loftics took David and they went home. They hired a physical fitness expert and a bodybuilder. They built a little gymnasium in the basement of their home and they went to work. It took a number of months before David could even move the length of his own body. One day, many months, probably about 2 to 3 years later, Bernie received a call from the therapist. He said, I believe David is ready. Come on home. Bernie Loftick rushed home. David was down in the gymnasium on a mat getting ready to do a push-up. And as that little body started to rise into the air, The physical and emotional exertion was so great, there was not a dry inch of skin on that little body. The mat looked as if you had sprinkled water on it. When that one perfect push-up was complete, Mom and Dad, the two sisters, David, the therapist, and several of the neighbors who were over there broke down and shed the tears which clearly say that happiness is not pleasure. Happiness is victory. The story is even more remarkable when we learn that one of America's leading universities had also examined David very carefully and discovered that there were no motor connections to the right side of his body. They had said to him, he has no sense of balance. He will never be able to swim or to skate or to ride a bicycle. On October the 23rd, 1971, my wife and I were in Winnipeg, Canada, to see little David Lifchik at his bar mitzvah. I wish you could have been there. I wish the television cameras of the world could have been there to see what we saw. That young boy, 13 years old, whom the doctors had said would never be able to walk or talk or count to 10, at that point in his life had already done as many as 1,100 push-ups in a single day, had run 6 miles nonstop, was doing extremely well as a seventh grader in ninth grade math at St. John's Ravenscourt School for Boys. He was running the wheels off his third bicycle, was skating on the neighborhood hockey team, was one of the best table tennis players in the city of Winnipeg, Canada. The next year, to the best of my knowledge, he became the first, and so far as we know, the only victim of cerebral palsy to qualify for an unrated, ordinary $100,000 life insurance policy. The reason I share with you so many of the details of David's story is because it involves the principles that we've been talking about all the way through. First of all, there was the foundation, which is solid. They were absolutely honest with the Lifchiks, and the Lifchiks, in turn, were honest with David. Character is, as Calvert Roberts says, the ability to carry out a good resolution long after the excitement of the moment has passed. It's one thing to agree with the doctor, you're going to do this for the next 15 years. It's another thing to do it for the next 15 years. Integrity, no question, all the way from day one. Loyalty, you've never seen a family that were so one as the Lifchik family is. Trust, don't you know that the trust had to be incredible? 3 hours every single day from then on in, David had to be in there working. Don't you know that when the doctor said there'll be years and years when you won't be able to see any change, that involved an incredible amount of trust? How many of us, for example, would have been willing to have hung in there all of that length of time? Love, one of the most beautiful love stories I think I've ever heard is this one. When David was about 2 years old, they had to start putting heavy leg braces on his legs every evening. And they had to make them progressively tighter. And every evening when Bernie and or Elaine would put those leg braces on, David would be there literally with tears in his eyes. And he had beautiful green eyes. He was a beautiful child. Cold black hair, olive complexion, with tears in his eyes saying, Mommy, do we have to put them on tonight? Or Daddy, do you have to make them so tight? And don't you know that any mother or father in existence would really have had trouble with that one? But Bernie and Elaine Lifchik loved David so much, they said no to the tears of the moment so they could say yes to the laughter of a lifetime. See, when you really love someone, you do for that person what is best for that person. Attitude, every night when they were putting David to bed, first Elaine and then later Bernie, when he would come in every night, he would awaken David and he'd hold him in his arms. He'd say, son, you're a champ. You can do anything you want to do, son, and Dad really loves you and Mom really loves you. He was one of the first people to get a cassette recorder. In those days, they were just coming out. And every day while he was taking his therapy, he would be listening to the motivation while he was taking the therapy. Self-image, obviously, as a child, he could not have a good one as an infant. But today, of course, he does. Relationships, probably nobody has ever worked as closely with and in better cooperation with others than David Lovchik has been working all of his life. Goals, we talk about daily goals and long-range goals and big goals. David Lovchik had literally hourly goals on many occasions. Nobody has ever worked too many harder than David Lovchik. Desire, when you start talking about desire, you're talking about a youngster who surpasses just about anybody in anything I've ever seen. The physical effort that went into all of this is absolutely astronomical. And David Lovchik, for one solid year, set his opportunity clock 1 hour earlier than any other member of the family. And when that clock would sound off, he'd get up and put his skates on, go out to that frozen swimming pool. And it took him one solid winter just to learn how to stand up on the ice. Later, he skated on the neighborhood hockey team. You've heard it said many times throughout the series that you can have everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. One of the interesting phenomena of this is that Bernie and Elaine Lovchik, in the process of providing David his opportunity in life, Bernie not only had to work smarter, but he also had to work harder. For 7 years, Bernie Lovchik worked 7 days and seven nights every week. He took off one Friday night in 7 years in order to provide the financial necessities for giving his son everything he needed. Today, Bernie Lovchik is an extraordinarily wealthy man. But it goes beyond that. You see, they embrace the free enterprise system. But what effect does this have on other people? Let me share with you one of the other little interesting sidelines about the fact that we never really do go through life by ourselves. I was speaking out in Lubbock, Texas here several years ago, and I told David's story. There was a young couple seated in the very front, and as I told the story, they were visibly moved and asked for a visit privately when it was over. We visited, and they asked me the name of the doctor who had taken Dr. Perlstein's place when Dr. Perlstein retired. I gave them that doctor's name. That little girl, she's 18 months old. They flew her to Chicago for the examination because she had cerebral palsy. The doctor examined this little girl thoroughly, and when he finished the examination, he said, "This little girl does not have cerebral palsy. She simply was born prematurely. She's a little slow developing her. She's been misdiagnosed. But because you have been treating her as if she had cerebral palsy, she has acquired some of the symptoms of the disease. Take her back and treat her as a normal, healthy little girl, and you will end up having the normal, healthy little girl that you really want to have." It's quite a story, the David Lovchik story. It involves an awful lot of principles. It's not easy, but I think you'll agree that it's a story that we can learn from. Many, many times over the course of the years, I have thought to myself, I wonder how much bigger and faster and stronger and smarter, I wonder how much more David Lovchik would have been had he been given the same chance in life that you and I were given. Then finally one day, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Had he been given more, he undoubtedly would have ended up with less. Maybe a whole lot less. Maybe that's the reason God tells us in his book to thank him for everything. What's the end of the story? Well, the story's not ended. That's the reason we can't really end it. But I can bring you up to date. David Lovchik today is a handsome young man of 29 years of age. 195 pounds, a barrel for a chest. Happily married, a proud papa. And for the last 2 years, he's been the number one condominium salesman in the number one real estate firm in Winnipeg, Canada, having a marvelous time and a marvelous career. The principles he learned as a child are standing him in good stead now and will for the rest of his life. You see, it's not the story I'm really talking about. It's the principles that we're talking about. When you apply these principles, do these things and follow through on them, I can close as I always do by saying, if you'll do that, then I'll see you. And yes, I really do mean you at the top. Thank you.